Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, and back to Italy we go. We started the year in Italy, and we're just headed right back there.
That's right.
Yeah.
I forgot. Okay.
Heck yeah. So we're going to talk about The Enchanted April, which was written in 1922 by Elizabeth von Arnim.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never heard of the author, but Enchanted April is a movie. I don't think I've seen it, but isn't that a film, just Enchanted April?
Yes, I never saw it either.
And I'm assuming that it is based on that book.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I guess there's actually been a few things. The Wikipedia page has, I don't know, like a play, a 1935 movie, an Academy Award nominated movie in 1991, Tony Award nominated Broadway stage play, a musical even, and radio drama in 2015 on the BBC.
Wow.
Which I would love to listen to because I love audio drama, but 2015, it's, you know, they just keep changing it. So I don't know.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. Would they leave the characters the way they are in the book? Or would they feel like they needed to update them?
Update them somehow. Yeah, it's like they keep doing these things, you know. Enchanted April, but in 2025 or whatever.
Well, you know? I know. It's like when you sent me the link today that said that Amazon Studios was going to now have all the rights to creating new James Bond movies.
Oh, boy.
I was like, without the Broccolis? What? Although the last movie I didn't like. However,
I didn't see it. I didn't see that yet.
Save your sale.
Yeah, save my quarter. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Your quarter. Paid a dime. They're really ripping you off. Anyway.
You put a quarter in the machine and it shows you a movie.
But you look at it and you just go, oh, great. So this opens the doors for how woke is the new James Bond going to be? You know, what are they going to fix, supposedly? Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah.
It's just... I don't want them to do that to Enchanted April either.
Right, right.
And maybe they won't. Because
maybe they didn't. I don't know.
So good the way it is.
Yeah, but I hear you. I'm with you, though.
Yeah.
But this was a terrific book. Another great pick.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you said earlier, we were talking just a little bit before the show, but that it reminded you a little bit of The Feast. And I had that same thought while reading it. So go ahead.
Because it's ostensibly about something that is completely different than what you find as a subtext when you're reading the book. So the feast is just this mystery about who was in the hotel when it collapsed and who died. And as they're telling the story, you're finding out, oh my goodness, look, there's the seven deadly sins. There's all this other stuff going on. And this book is, in a sense, almost the opposite of that, I guess. It's four women going on a vacation, and they don't know each other, really, or at least not very well. And then everything starts happening as kind of below the surface.
Mm.
Like it says, the servants are confused because other people have rented this house during the spring, and they've had parties, and they've gone places to sightsee and everything. These women just kind of wander around and sit in different parts of the house and don't even talk to each other. They're like, we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, and they kind of come together at dinner time. Yeah.
Yeah. But the book is telling you all the things they're thinking or little conversations they're having with each other and about the life they have come from and what their fears or hopes are. And so that makes it sound also kind of like this real introspective book, but it's really rich and open and it's beautiful. It's filled with beauty.
Yeah, I agree. Filled with beauty is great, great description. And it's not very long, but there are, you know, because I'm afraid what I'm going to say is turn someone off the book.
Yeah.
But there are pages of just inside people's heads.
Yeah.
And you're like, this person is thinking this and that. And it's masterful in that how they're relating to each other is shown. And then their reactions to that internally is shown. And eventually they start moving forward, you know. And I was never bored reading this book. It was super interesting. Even though my description may not sound interesting.
that's the problem with this book, which is why I never watched the movie. I was like,
what can they do in the movie, you know? And it would be problematic. And, you know, gosh, they did a play and all these other things. And that's very interesting because they're going to have to do it all out loud.
I wonder,
it's just not going to be as special as this book is, you know, because the faces that they show to each other and then their examination of what they had just done or what their life has been up to now. And, but it's like that thing, you know, like we show faces to people in certain situations, you know, like in this situation, I kind of need to be like this. And in this, you know, it's our own perception of how we need to be with these different groups of people. Mm-hmm. There is this bedrock of truth underneath it all.
And let me just, for anybody who, I mean, I know we have one person who specifically told us that they listen until we say spoilers and then they actually go away and often will read or watch whatever, which is so wonderful. I can't tell you how good that made me feel.
That's neat.
But so let me give a brief synopsis of how things get going, which is that there's this woman who March, the end of March, and it's raining and foggy and cold and damp in London. And she is very unhappy in her marriage and not to the point of doing anything drastic, but she's just feeling, you know, blah about everything. And she sees an ad in the paper when she's at her club and she is reading the ads and there's an ad saying, come to San Salvatore Castello, I think, castle in Italy for a month in April. It's, you know, beautiful sunshine, ocean, all these things. It just seems like an impossible dream to her. And she says, because it says, you know, call or write for the price. And as she's doing that, she's thinking, oh, I'd love that. But I've got a little money saved up out of my household money, but I don't think I can do it. And she looks up and sees someone who she's kind of acquainted with through church, I believe, who's a real good deed doer. But she's sitting looking at a copy of the same paper, just staring into space. And she goes up to her and says, you're reading that ad, aren't you? And as it turns out, that ad is on that page, so that's not what the woman was thinking about. And she goes, we could probably split up the cost and go, let's do it. And this woman keeps trying to put her off. But she's like, I also would really like to do this. This would be great. Because she was thinking about her unhappy marriage and her unhappy life and how even though she wants to do good all the time, she can't do good. And this is in the first like chapter or two, so I'm not giving away a lot. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is they go find out the cost and go, oh, we can't really afford it. But if we got a few more people to share it with us, we could all split it up. And so they decide they're going to look for two more people. And they put the ad in the paper of their own. And they only get two people. So it's like these people were deliberately chosen. When you're reading the book later, you look back and because Lottie, who was the first woman, said she thought they'd get lots of people. They only got two. So these were the four people who were going to go. And one of them is an older lady who spends a lot of time in her very big, rich house thinking about all the famous people she knew when she was young. And the other one is a young socialite. Is the most beautiful person anyone has ever seen. And they know almost nothing about her, but she can come up with the money. And what you do know is she's happy she doesn't know any of these people. She just wants to be somewhere where she doesn't know anyone. And so they all say, well, on the 1st of March, we'll meet up at the castle, and they all go on their separate ways. And you see the first two women who, since they kind of know each other, they travel together. And you see them on their journey and getting there, and then
And they show up a day earlier than everyone else. Yep.
They wanted to get the house ready for everyone. Well, everybody else had the same idea, not getting the house ready, but getting there first to pick out their rooms. So anyway, so that kind of is what sets everything into motion. And then, it's hard to describe.
Yeah. From then on, it's them relating to each other and affecting each other.
Yeah. Unexpected changes occur, says the back of the book. And that's true. And because, as Scott was saying, you're so intimately involved with what these people are thinking about, they come to life quickly for you. And, well, most of them. Mrs. Yeah, Fisher took a long time. All four
of them are very distinct, different folks. You know?
And I would say that just like the Feast, it's or maybe the TARDIS, it's bigger on the inside. The story seems very slight. Or Miss Bunkle's book even, where it was a basic story, but there was a lot going along under the surface.
Sure, yeah.
Right? And right. So these are these slight stories where there's a lot more happening than you expect when you read it.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend it. And if you don't like it, you can stop halfway. Every library has one. Every used bookstore.
Yes.
I'm sure it's on the Kindle cheap. Or
it was. I can't remember what I paid for it, but yeah.
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 So.
Yep, I got the Penguin edition on Kindle. But it's public domain, so I'm sure you can get it for a dollar.
Yeah. And I had it on or Kindle, less. But I bought myself an actual copy of it to read.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The Penguin Classics edition.
Fantastic. So we're reading the same thing. Yes.
Yes.
That's great. But yeah, definitely read it. Yep.
Yeah, and it's not just a girly book because Scott liked it. And other That's men right. I've heard, like on podcasts, reading podcasts and things, have liked it too.
Yeah, so. It's good. Yeah. It's good. All right. So there's our spoiler line.
Okay.
So off we go. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, so that first scene was interesting. She really didn't know. And that was Wilkins, I believe. Lottie Wilkins.
Yeah, Mrs. Wilkins.
And she's the one who came across that and was like, boy, I'd really like to do that. And then Rose Arbuthnot is the one that she saw reading the paper and just went over there. So it was like they kind of were in the same social group, or whether it was a women's group or their church group or something. And
yeah,
then
they're at their club then. Yeah. So,
but they hadn't ever really talked. So Lottie Wilkins going over to her was, that was new. So she was meeting, it was like she was meeting Rose for the first time, but, they had been in the same circles. And it was interesting, like you said, like Rose initially pushing back and saying, no, I mean, we're not going to do that. And then all that inner thoughts and all that stuff going on in her head. And she's like, you know, I really do want to do this. Why am I saying no? And, go ahead.
And then she's thinking about why she's saying no, which is like, well, really, any extra money should be spent on the poor.
Yes.
Because she is very driven by, she doesn't approve of what her husband does for a living, which is write books about famous women in history who had affairs.
Yeah, mistresses.
I assume they're rather salacious. But like if it was a current day, you know, out there modern romance writer or something. So she's trying to, she couldn't get him to quit. And he's super successful, right? So what she has done is turn her whole life to doing good works in church. She's basically trying to, like, it's like an indulgence almost. She's trying to buy his way into heaven.
Yes.
But doing it has cut her off from him. And it has turned her into somebody who's not actually doing her faith because she loves God. It's like she's trying to buy her way into heaven or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
she doesn't think of it that way. But I did hear Father Mike Schmitz a few weeks ago, I guess, in one of his homilies talking about an old priest who said he was praying one time and he heard quite distinctly while he was praying, and it was basically the voice of God saying, you used to love me, now you just work for me. It was like, that describes Mrs. Rose Arbuthnot.
Yeah, and I remember some descriptions of her and her husband, you know, as she was considering this, and she said that she felt like she had to choose between her religion and him. And she chose her religion because at least she wasn't alone. Something like that.
Yeah, it's so sad.
So yeah, it was extremely sad, but he was like uninterested in it. And and then she was the one, I mean, it talked about prayer a lot in this book in relation to her. Because she was worried, you know, she needed to pray. It was like a thing on her to-do list. And then she started to forget to do that. And then next thing you know, she went a few days without doing it. And now she was noting that. Why did I forget that? I can't believe I did that, you know. And all this kind of leads to her almost like a conversion, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, why am I doing this in the first place? And I think, you know, people talk about changing your scenery as a help to various things, you know, spiritual things even. But, you know, Jesus went out in the desert, you know, and we get Lent and those things where we're changing our life situation kind of on purpose during Lent. And what that does is it brings things forth. And that's sort of what happened to her.
Yeah, because then it's like going on a retreat or like even just going on vacation or something, like you're saying, just changing your scene. It takes you out of all your routines. You're not paying bills. You're not going to the grocery store. You're not, as she would be, going to give talks about giving to the poor. You're not doing all these various things. And so suddenly you've got time to think and time for God to get in there.
Yeah.
And so Mrs. Wilkins, the first one who notices it, she is thinking about her life. She kind of has this resignation about her life because her husband only pays attention to her when he's taken her to some like art event or something, because he's a lawyer. And so he's always trying to get these rich clients. So she's then the wife when there's some opening or, you know, and the rest of the time, all she's trying to do is make the stuff he likes to eat or be the person that he needs her to be. And says nobody took any notice of Mrs. Wilkins. She was the kind of person who is not noticed at parties. Her clothes, infested by thrift, made her practically invisible. Mm. Her face was non-arresting. Her conversation was reluctant. She was shy. And if one's clothes and face and conversation are all negligible, thought Mrs. Wilkins, who recognized her disabilities, what at parties is left of one? And her husband always looked great. He was highly thought of. She was just there, you know, to complete the picture for him to get, you know, clients and everything. And I think the thing I love reading this bit about her is she's the one who, in order to do this, she's not negligible. She's not shy. She's not fading into the background because she's the one who makes Mrs. Arbuthnot look for the ad. She's the one he keeps pushing. Mm. She's the first one who changes when they go to San Salvatore and start saying, I can see this happening. I can see this person better. I can see inside of them.
Yeah, love that.
And saying things where Mrs. Fisher and Carolyn are both kind of like, she just keeps bursting out, doesn't she? And Carolyn thinks, it's the original, you know, with a capital O. So in the 1920s, there'd have been somebody who was like, well, let me just say what I'm thinking. And so you read this beginning, and then the whole rest of the book, she's not like that.
Hmm.
Even when she meets Mrs. Fisher, she's so busy bursting out in conversation and her thoughts that Mrs. Foster suddenly goes, or Miss Fisher, I'm sorry, Mrs. Fisher says, I think I need references before I come to take a room at your house. And they go, no, we ask you for the references. She goes, no, I need to make sure you guys are okay. And this is so unlike the person we meet in the first chapter.
Oh, how nice.
Just the thought of it starts to change her. And you see who she really is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, I love that line. You know, I see it. I see that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was used over and over to great effect.
I see this happening. And seeing and light and vision are very important all the way through the book.
And beauty, like you said.
Yeah, and beauty. Right. Because when they get to San Salvatore, which means Holy Savior, I heard some people saying it was like Dante's Inferno, like Purgatorio book, right?
Okay.
You start off down with the water, and you're going up the mountain, and then you break into a beautiful garden, which is the Garden of Eden.
Oh, nice.
And that actually works. But for me, once I heard that and I was thinking about it, I thought, this is actually kind of like the Transfiguration.
Hmm.
Because once those four women get up there with the beauty and the light, and they're kind of all relaxing and thinking and changing a little bit, in different stages, suddenly people are going, oh, when they first got here, I thought they were plain, but these women are all actually very pretty.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do remember that, yeah.
So it's like you can see who people really are up there in that light with the beauty all around them changing them.
That's beautiful, yeah.
And it kind of made me think about, is this what heaven is like in terms of, and if you think of a Garden of Eden or a paradise kind of idea, or the transfiguration where you see the true person of Jesus.
Yeah.
They have to come back down the mountain at the end of the book, but the whole experience has changed them because they can see and be seen.
Yeah.
Because that's Lady Carolyn's problem. She's so beautiful, but all people want to do is grasp at her beauty.
Yes. Yeah.
And date her and be with her and you know, bother her on the bus. And
yeah, she called them grabbers.
Grabbers, that's it.
Yeah. Grabbers. Yeah. And, so they had, when they first arrived there, they were surprised to find that they had a long path to walk to get to the front door. And that made me think, you know, well, that's leaving life, right? It's like, it's like, you know, when we go to Mass and we go into the church, it's like we're supposed to be leaving shore and
yes.
You spend that hour, you know, praising God. And then when you leave, you're returning to the world, you know,
Then
it's kind of like that, you know, they actually had to make a trek to get there. And
and they were on an uncomfortable train,
mm-hmm.
and then they get into the carriage, and the guy who's loading the carriage up with their suitcases, and this is a horse and carriage because it's the 1920s, the horse just takes off. He knows where he's supposed to go, and they're in the dark. Everybody there looks very suspicious to them because these were all Italian peasants who were doing all this stuff, and they're like, "Oh no, we're going to be robbed! Oh no, what's going to happen to us?" And it's streaming down rain. It's totally dark. They don't know where they're going. And at one point, they're kind of like hanging off the edge of the mountain with this little tiny road that's got no wall between it and the precipice and the sea below. And then, as you say, they get out and they're like, yeah, there you go. Enjoy. There's no lighting, of course. It's the 1920s and they're in the total darkness going up this path.
Mm.
They don't know where they're going.
Yeah. And it takes quite a while. I mean, not an incredible amount of time, but it's quite a hike. And they have to get up there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that just reminded me of going to the desert or leaving a situation to another situation, that path. So.
Yeah, and the rain is almost like the baptism. I mean, if we're going to talk about that stuff, yeah, it's the death to self.
Right, and it is, yeah.
And then the Holy Spirit can work, and so... since San Salvatore is the name of the castle, but that means Holy Savior. So they keep saying nervously to everyone, San Salvatore, because they can't speak Italian. And they, yes, San Salvatore, we're going to it. We're going to be saved, basically.
Yeah.
And it's Easter's coming, right? That keeps getting mentioned over and over and over. So they're there during Easter for the resurrection.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was wondering what the author's background is. You know, with all this stuff in there, you know, I think it's intentional. But I don't know a lot about her background. Do you?
No, I've heard histories of her given by people, but they mostly talk about how many husbands she had and how her writing career started. And the place she's describing in the book is a place that it's a different name because I think it was called Brown Castle or something, but it was that place that she was describing.
Wow. So this is really interesting.
Okay.
So it says here that her first marriage made her Countess von Arnim Schlagenthin, and her second Elizabeth Russell, Countess Russell. And this is after her first husband's death, she had a 3-year affair with H.G. Wells.
That's the stuff everybody always talks about.
Yeah. And then she later married Frank Russell, who is the brother of Bertrand Russell.
I know. She was connected.
Yeah. So isn't Bertrand Russell, wasn't he an atheist? A famous atheist, like one of the arguers of atheism?
I would have to look. Let me just see.
But I'm just kind of looking at this in Wikipedia right now.
Yeah,
but yeah. So, anyway.
Also, I think she was in high society because of all those husbands and things. So she was always, I think, giving big parties and moving and shaking and being the life of the party, very clever, all that kind of thing. And I think you'd have to be with H.G. Wells for 3 years. And I don't know about her faith, but I think in this book, those things have to be deliberate because the author chose to put them in and emphasize them.
Hmm.
She didn't have to call it Holy Savior Castle.
Right, right.
You know, she didn't have to call it, say that it was going to be Easter and all the things. And, I mean, she chose all that stuff. And even when it says occasionally, it's like, you know, Mrs. Wilkins would disappear for a day and she's, oh, I was down in the village and I was up on the mountain. I was doing, you don't ever go with those people to do that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really the only one who leaves like that. Everybody else, just, you see them in the castle. And when Lottie's gone, she's gone. Everybody's like, where'd she go? I don't know. I haven't seen her all day. You know, you don't go and see what they're thinking or doing. Only what's happening in the castle is important.
Yeah, how interesting. Yeah. So I just verified. So Bertrand Russell is that famous atheist that I was thinking about. So, yeah, H.G. Wells was also a staunch atheist. So this is really a fascinating book to come from a person with that background. Because she was very,
she was around.
Yeah, of course, of course. But yeah, because Rose Arbuthnot, she was a very pious person. And these things that we're talking about were, you know, she's kind of fallen away from it while still participating in it. She was never, the author was never disrespectful to her. It was never a slam or anything. It was very interesting to read. And, you know, where she ended up was also super interesting. So she was dealing with all of these things as, respectful and, yeah, I don't think any things that you brought up or I brought up so far have been unintentional.
No,
so because, yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, I think because you know, there's no organized religion or anything, but I think more than anything, what this is showing is something you said to me in an email. I think, which is like, look at how being around each other changes these people.
Yeah.
And that makes it sound as if they're all like, well, now that we're friends, we can all see this stuff. No, two of the people don't want to have anything to do with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
The two people who are separate, Mrs. Fisher and Carolyn, Lady Carolyn.
Yeah.
They just want to be by themselves. One of them to think about all her stuff from her past, the old lady, and the other one to just not have anybody even look at her because she knows they're going to want to grab onto her. And the other two who know each other some, they are talking and doing stuff, but they're still also on a different path. Like Mrs. Arbuthnot, Mrs. Fisher insists on sitting at the end of the table and acting like she's the hostess and passing out things for tea and doing all this stuff. And Mrs. Arbuthnot is like furious over this because she's like, we're the ones who set this up. We're the ones who should be running the castle. Why are you doing this? So every time Mrs. Fisher says, would you like some milk in your tea? She says, no, would you like some in yours? And Mrs. Fisher's like, why does she answer everything I say with a question? And Mrs. Arbuthnot, Rose Arbuthnot, is just like, why won't she let me be the hostess like I'm supposed to? She's not running this. And the whole time what happens is from very early on, Mrs. Wilkins says, what does it matter? Just let her do it.
Yeah.
Who cares? It doesn't matter. And she suddenly starts shedding all the things like this that are inconsequential.
Yes.
Just, well, if it makes her happy, what do we care? Let
right,
her do it.
Right.
And that's so hard to let go of those little petty things sometimes like
that. Oh, sure.
Because they're trying to establish rank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And this is Mrs. Wilkins going, but what rank doesn't matter.
Yes.
You know, which is kind of where you come back to the Garden of Eden.
Right.
I mean, this is a fairy tale type story, obviously. And you're in the enchanted garden and the enchanted April and the enchanted castle. But it's just this thing of, and they're being fed the best food.
Yes.
Because nobody will actually take responsibility for things like ordering the meals.
Yeah. And wasn't it?
And the cook gets to do what she wants, so she gives them the stuff she likes to cook with, which is the very best stuff that she can't afford otherwise.
Yeah. Wasn't it Mrs. Fisher who was upset when she learned that they were letting the servants just do their thing?
Yeah.
pick out the food and everything?
She said, my Italian is the Italian of Dante, so naturally I can't talk to the servants about meals.
Oh my gosh.
So she's very important. And she goes, go to Lady Carolyn. And Lady Carolyn could talk to them, but she didn't want to talk to anyone about anything like that or anything at all.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Arbuthnot and Mrs. Wilkins couldn't speak Italian. So the cook's like, well, then I'll just do what I want. And my family, who has farms and shops and everything, I'll use all their stuff and we'll all have fun. And we'll all get rich.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And then there was so let's talk about a turning point. So everybody has gone there to be alone. And, you know, to be alone in this big castle, but together, right? But that's really what they're doing is they're all, like Carolyn is always finding a place to think. You know, finally I get to sit down and think, but her mind is just too busy. She can't settle down to think. And, but anyway, then Lottie Wilkins has seen some things or felt some things, and she's like, I want my husband to come now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was a big turning point to everything. I mean, the arguments that they had over that, you know, I don't want your husband to come here, you know, and everybody wanted to say that. Some of them didn't say it out loud, but they were just arguing against it. There's only this many beds. Where's he going to be? You know, there's eight beds, but only six rooms. Yeah. It was quite a deal.
I kind of understood what Mrs. Fisher said, too, when she was like, men are going to ruin everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would be that way also if it was a group of men and somebody wanted to bring a woman. It just breaks up what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it introduces a source of tension that nobody wants.
Right.
Although Mrs. Fisher was just like, and beds. Why do people keep talking about men and beds? And this is the Victorian in her, you feel like. Mm-hmm. It's like, because what happens when you have wives and husbands and beds? I don't want to think about it. anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But that was a big, you know, disturbance in their calm pond. And that was the beginning, I think, of everybody suddenly or moving down a path to where they understood themselves a lot better and realized what they had in the life that they left.
Mm-hmm.
And they all wanted their life back in a way. And Lady Carolyn, I think you said, she realized how selfish she had been. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing is, you know, I can sympathize with her, you know, when she just can't walk down the street and be left alone. I'm sure that that's got to be a difficult thing to deal with all the time. But at the same time, that made her put a wall around herself, and now she wasn't available to anybody. And that was going to make her sad, you know?
Yeah, because at one point, isn't she talking about, somebody's talking about her mother, and she suddenly starts thinking about her mother, like really thinking about her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking something like, oh, she was so good to do these things for me. Oh, she could be so funny. She could be thinking of her very fondly, really.
Yeah.
And kind of suddenly realizing that, oh, actually, my mother's not just an annoyance. I like my mother.
Hmm.
You know? Yeah. And Mrs. I'm trying to think. Mrs. Fisher is much later on. A lot of them are much later on.
Yeah.
The changes that happened, and I was thinking, you know, when you talked about, I realize I'm kind of changing the subject here, but when you said that God's mentioned all the time, some of the conversations that happen, they're all have Mrs. Wilkins in them. When somebody will say something definitively that we kind of take as a truism, like, Mrs. Arbuthnot had said, you know, well, I've been very good, and, you know, being good is all you should need. And Mrs. Wilkins went, oh, no, that's not true at all. We've been very good, and we need a lot of rest from that. We've been trying and trying and trying, and we can't do it ourselves, so we just need to take a complete rest from it.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have an answer for that.
Yes.
Because it's this outside the box thinking. And at one point, this describing again, it's like every week, you know, some kind of flower goes away, but all these other things bloom. And so then she stops and describes it, and it's wonderful. And it says, and Mrs. Fisher's been just terrible. And it says, they stood looking at this crowd of loveliness, this happy jumble in silence, all the flowers and everything. No, it didn't matter what Mrs. Fisher did. Not here, not in such beauty. Mrs. Arbuthnot's discomposure melted out of her. In the warmth and light of what she was looking at, of what to her was a manifestation, an entirely new side of God, how could one be discomposed? If only Frederick were with her, seeing it too, seeing as he would have seen it when they first were lovers, in the days when he saw what she saw and loved what she loved. She sighed. You mustn't sigh in heaven, said Mrs. Wilkins. One doesn't. I was thinking how one longs to share this with one, those one loves, said Mrs. Arbuthnot. You mustn't long in heaven, said Mrs. Wilkins. You're supposed to be quite complete there. And it is heaven, isn't it, Rose? And so she's talking about it. And at one point, Mrs. Arbuthnot says, well, Mrs. Wilkins isn't perfectly happy. And she says, oh, she'll start being in a while. But the thing is what Mrs. Arbuthnot is saying is actually also true. Because Mrs. Wilkins, almost as soon as she realizes all the beauties there, she starts wishing she could share it with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Arbuthnot, as we see, she also is wishing she could share it with her husband. Her husband, as she knew when he would appreciate something like this, maybe not now, but back then when they first fell in love.
Mm.
So they're all longing for the perfection of the people that they love and that they can share this beauty.
Yeah.
And the thing that's interesting to me, and I realize I'm really jumping around, so I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
The thing that's interesting to me is when these two men actually do show up, they do appreciate it, not in the same way, but they become better versions of themselves because of the place they are and because of how their wives have changed before they greet them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Mellersh, which is Mr. Wilkins' name, I found out it's a family name. So it's like if somebody was named, his mother's name was Taylor, and so he's named Taylor so-and-so kind of thing, because it's such a weird name. But anyway, he shows up, and he's excited about this because he's like, oh, my gosh, she's there with Lady Carolyn, and I've heard of Mrs. Fisher, I think. I think she's got a lot of money. This is going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
And the first thing that happens is he takes a bath and nobody has warned him about the peculiarities of the water heater and how the bath reacts. And so the bath kind of explodes with hot water all over. And so he's running out because it's terrifying. And he's only wrapped in a towel. And that's when he meets Lady Carolyn, who cannot keep from laughing because all she could do is look at his long naked legs. And, you know, and he is perfectly dignified with the speech he'd memorized and everything. But he then runs into his wife, who, as it turns out, she's just so happy he's there and treating him so wonderfully. And he's saying, you're the wife that I wanted all along. You know,
yeah.
Because he's now not got anything to try to mold her into. And she's so happy to see him. She's just perfectly agreeable with whatever he wants. So he's got everything he needs. And then when he's around the people who he's hoping to have be clients, it's funny because he keeps thinking, I want to solve their problems for them if they have any, because then they'll trust me when they have legal problems, which is a kind of funny way to think about it. Because by the end of the book, he stopped kind of adding on the little mental bit about, because when they need a lawyer, they'll call me. He's just looking at them going, oh, well, we have to help this person. And now I have to make this person comfortable. And he can't solve any particular problems that he notices, but just by being agreeable in the way that they like. He's never grabbing at Lady Carolyn. He's treating Mrs. Fisher just the way she likes to be treated, kind of like a warm grandmother or something, or a very distinguished old lady. He himself begins to change into the person who cares more about the people than what he could get from them.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a little paragraph here feeds right into it. It says, so Mellersh is there, right? It says, Mrs. Arbuthnot was astonished. The extraordinary quickness with which, hour by hour, under her very eyes, Lottie became more selfless, disconcerted her. She was turning into something surprisingly like a saint. Here she was now being affectionate about Mellersh. Mellersh, who only that morning, while they hung their feet into the sea, had seemed a mere iridescence. Lottie had told her, a thing of gauze. That was only that morning, and by the time they had lunch, Lottie had developed so far as to have got him solid enough again to write to, and to write to at length.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Arbuthnot is observing Wilkins and, you know, being changed
Rose,
by it.
Yeah.
Sorry. Well, I feel like that fed into what you were saying, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, because at least she's opening herself up to the idea of, look at this change that's happening. And she cannot quit thinking, Rose Arbuthnot cannot quit thinking about her husband.
Mm-hmm.
She just wants him back. The way he was.
Mm-hmm.
And so she actually finally, she worries because she wants, Lottie has been saying, write to him. Just write to him and ask him to come. And she doesn't want to because she knows he'll say no. And she finally does it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just shows up really quick. Now, of course, it turns out that he never got that letter because he was somewhere else and he's chasing Lady Caroline. Because he's been so unhappy. He's been living quite a different lifestyle in London in his own apartment a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, though, is that when he sees Rose, she thinks he's come in because of her letter. So she's so happy and so welcoming and so loving and so sweet. And it's in the way that he remembered from when they were happy and first married before she started, asking him with patient obstinacy what he thought the things he wrote and lived by looked in the eyes of God. No one, she said once, should ever write a book God wouldn't like to read. That is the test, Frederick. And he had laughed hysterically, burst into a great shriek of laughter, and rushed out of the house, away from her solemn little face, away from her pathetic, solemn little face. And then he says, but this was the rose of his youth. The best part of his life, the part of it that had had all the visions in it and all the hopes, how they had dreamed together, he and she, before he struck that vein of memoirs, how they had planned and laughed and loved. They had lived for a while in the very heart of poetry. And then he thinks, he's still thinking about it, and it says, it was wonderful to have it all come back to him at the touch of her, at the feel of her face against his. Wonderful that she should be able to give him back his youth. And they're calling each other sweetheart and beloved husband and, you know, clinging to each other and having a wonderful time and just, you know, being in love. And so this is, toward the end of the book, I think it's probably got to be Mrs. Wilkins, who's like just, it's love that makes the difference. Love is what changes things. And one of the things that, in fact, this is the spot I was looking at. So Scrap is looking, this is very close to the end of the book, Scrap, Lady Caroline, is looking at Frederick and Rose as they're wandering into the darker parts of the garden, you know, hands entwined and maybe who knows what else is going on. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of like, it's so weird because, you know, everybody seems to be changed by this. And she's kind of worried about it. She says, it seems grabby, but even though it isn't, you know, she doesn't know how to think about it. And I suppose, whispered Lottie, Rose's husband seems to you just an ordinary, good-natured, middle-aged man. And says, Scrap brought her gaze down from the stars and looked at Lottie a moment while she focused her mind again. Just a rather red, rather round man, whispered Lottie. Scrap bowed her head. He isn't, whispered Lottie. Rose sees through all that. That's mere trimmings. She sees what we can't see because she loves him. Always love. And that's when she starts thinking about, she starts getting the clear vision of herself. And she is suddenly able to kind of open up because she can see Mrs. Fisher is suddenly becoming this wonderful, warm, grandmotherly person. And Mrs. Fisher could feel herself changing. She was like, it was weird. She felt like she was an old tree, but there were buds getting ready to break out everywhere. Youth. And it's because she'd wanted a family. Mm. And she'd never gotten one.
Yeah.
I mean, she'd been married, but the marriage wasn't what she thought it should be or had expected. I don't know. They weren't, didn't really spell it out. Mm. But she, there weren't any kids. And this, the owner of the house shows up, drawn by Rose, but immediately attracted to Scrap, the way every young man is. And but he sees Mrs. Fisher, and he's always wanted family. He was orphaned young. He had no other relatives. And so he's like, oh, my gosh. It's like she's a grandmother, you know. Mm. And so Scrap is seeing all this, and he is just enjoying the heck out of all the people there. And she suddenly says, it's so unfair that he won't be happy, because she knows he would. He's fallen in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
He won't be happy, and I'll be the reason.
Mm.
And then she stops and thinks about what he's given her just by the ad to rent the castle.
Yeah.
And she says, I have to thank you. You have given all this to me. And she's suddenly thinking of someone else and extending herself for someone else and being unselfish and opening the door to where somebody could get close to her, and she doesn't think of it as grabbing.
Wow. Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. And I've got a little piece here too that's near what you said.
Good.
Near what you read. It says, it's a great thing, whispered Lottie after a pause, during which they both watched Rose's upturned face, to get on with one's loving.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you can tell me of anything else in the world that works such wonders. But Scrap couldn't tell her, and if she could have, what a night to begin arguing in. This was a night for, and then she pulled herself up. Love again. It was everywhere. There was no getting away from it. She had come to this place to get away from it, and here was everybody in its different stages. Yeah, beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I do love that all the relationships, it's not just about husband and wife, because it's Briggs wants a family, and so does Mrs. Fisher. And they all and they can appreciate each other as friends, like Rose and Lottie, in ways that they never would have experienced otherwise. And then the beauty of the garden, which is, as Mrs. Arbuthnot sees, a different face of God. You know, they're in the middle of that. And do you think that may be a little glimpse of what the beatific vision is?
Yeah, yeah.
When you can really, you know who each, you're not married anymore, right? All that stuff. But you still know who your friends were, and your spouse, and your kids, and you just can love each other purely.
Yeah.
In the midst of beauty.
That's great. Yeah, that connection you made with the Transfiguration is just beautiful. It's very, very much right. Yep.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, it really puts the cap on the whole thing, because, you know, that's what brings it all together. But yeah, all these people just realizing what love does. It is like they had to escape to be without it in order to understand it and want it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It had been looked at in so many ways that were so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to use the word perverted, but it was just twisted, I guess, out of what love should be.
Mm.
In the ways that the marriages were working, or Scrap with everybody she met, or Lady Carolyn, or Mrs. Fisher, who were just, you know, alone and wanted to be alone and wanted to be have nobody around. And watching them all kind of get pulled straight and understood properly together.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little transcendent. But there's also funny parts, you know.
Oh, sure.
Some of the way things are put, the thing with the exploding bathtub, and, you know, when Mrs. Fisher is like, I'm going to keep everybody out of my room, but they keep coming in here and sitting down. She's grabbed, like, the two best, the best bedroom and the best sitting room and all this. And she starts moving plants around and furniture around so no one could get any doors open but the ones that she wants to use. You know, literally barring people out of her life. And it's just the way it goes, because the servants are coming in going, well, no one can get through that door. That's right. You know?
yeah.
I don't know. It's just funny.
It was funny. And the explosion of the tub was hilarious.
Yes. Because
she said something like, yeah, the instructions said this, but he did that.
Yeah. Because they were in Italian.
He's a lawyer and he's ignoring the instructions. It just made funny. Yeah.
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 And no one knew he was taking the bath, and the servants were all somewhere else, because usually the servants would have to gather around and manage the flow of the water and the heating of it, because the touchiness of all the equipment and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the whole, you know, I see them this and that. Mrs. Fisher complaining about it. I don't see, you know, you know, just letting her have it. And then, and then at the very end, let's see, was it Wilkins? I mean, it was Mr. and Mrs. Wilkins together, mm-hmm. but almost the last line of the book is, I see them being the Briggses, I think. Yeah.
And she was trying to figure out, she says, the Carolines. No, that's not right. The whatever. And she goes, I see them being the Briggses.
Yeah.
And she's, because she's the one who's been seeing, she'd just say, I see this. And it would be stuff like that where Mrs. Fisher would go, oh, I've got to really get her in line. She's just, something's really wrong with this one. She can't go around talking like that all the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, so well done. Have you read anything else by her?
No, I have heard of her other next most famous book. I think it's called Elizabeth's German Garden.
Oh.
Or something like that. Let's
see. Okay. Yep, I have not heard of that one.
Maybe the first book she ever wrote. Let's see here. Elizabeth and Her German Garden. That's from 1898. Semi-autobiographical. And I think it's another very gentle book like this. I don't know if there's more to it.
Okay.
Or if it's just, you know, you're kind of following this woman in her life and with her German garden and her children and whatever's going on.
So I looked at her bibliography earlier today, and the only one that I think I recognized was The Pastor's Wife. Is that a famous book? Or maybe it was a movie or something?
It might be. There is another one that's famous, not as famous as this, and I think it's a lot darker.
Hmm. Okay.
Not so much wandering in the garden with your face turned up.
Yes. And she wrote a book called Christine, which I assume was not about a haunted car.
Well, if we're lucky. I didn't like that one.
Yeah, that was like
take that, Stephen King.
That was like a high school novel again, kind of like Carrie.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly. This says the other famous book. This is just the introduction to my Penguin classics.
Mm-hmm.
Says Vera. It was I guess well received, and that was 1921.
Yeah, that was the year before this one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a little bump right there in the 20s.
Yeah.
Good for her.
She wrote over 20 books, so you know things were going on and.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just really, this time through, the first time I heard this, I could swear that Classic Tales Podcast read it.
Mm-hmm. That's the one I listened to. Yeah.
Oh, was it? Okay. Uh-huh. He's such a good reader.
Oh, he's terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. And B.J. Harrison?
Yeah, B.J. Harrison, right.
Yeah. And the thing that got me, I might have to listen to that again, because this is when I realized how funny it was.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to his narration of things, you know, I mean, and of course there's all the beautiful parts and the, you know, it's raining in London and all this stuff, but there's little bits of dialogue, where it's just funny or little even descriptions or how they're thinking, you know, where it's a bit sarcastic sometimes. And, then I read along with it for one of these literary podcasts I listened to that talks about the meanings of books was doing it. And I reread it and I went, oh my gosh. And that time I kind of thrilled to all the descriptions of the gardens and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this time through, I was just thinking about this book going, you know, there's so much in it. And when I was reading it, I was like, I was so glad I picked it. Though I realize I really feel like I've sounded incoherent through this thing because I just keep skipping from thing to thing. But
you aren't incoherent to me.
Okay, good. Well, you're the one who's listening to me, so that's what counts. And hopefully everyone else can keep up.
Yep.
But it just was so multi-layered.
Yeah, it really was. And again, you know, these inner lives of all four of these main characters. And it's really, again, I use the word masterful, but, you know, to to do that, you know, with the dialogue and then the realization of their inner realization of what it means, what they just said, and how they are with them and what they're missing and what their life has been. And, you know, like, I mean, there's just, it was masterful, you know?
And yeah. It just, it was really good. You're not bored.
No, not at all.
Usually that would be boring. It would be boring. But it's not.
Yeah. And it's not long. It doesn't stay too long. It's just, you really, it's almost perfect. It's really great.
Yeah, because you really don't know how they're going to pull it all off. And in fact, at the very end, because you think, well, no way Mrs. Fisher's going to be happy. She doesn't need a man. And that clearly seemed to be partway through the book where this was all going with the husbands. But what happens is because Mr. Briggs shows up. He's the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always wanted a family. So he's just loving having this older woman here. And he's talking to her and treating her like she's his beloved grandmother, and she starts acting like it and talking back like it because she's been feeling this inner growth that she doesn't want to admit to anyone, but like the buds are shooting out, right?
Yes.
That she's been thinking about. And then when Mellersh and Lottie come in and they see her, she's laughing and talking with him, and she just impulsively, the way she is now, gives her a kiss on the cheek, and she like holds her face, the Mrs. Fisher holds Lottie's face against hers.
Mm.
And she says, oh, she'd been thinking she really needs a friend, like a family member, like a grandchild, like somebody. And when that happens, Lottie goes, oh, I think it's going to be me. I think I'm the one who's going to be your friend. Oh. Because and it's like, so somebody, there's somebody for everyone. They'll maybe always stay in touch or not, but this family type of a group has changed each other in this way that's just inexplicable, because that's how it happens in our lives. I mean, we could talk about Mrs. Arbuthnot kept talking about God and praying to God and preaching about giving to the poor, and all these are the things you're supposed to do. But our relationship with God, those are the outer manifestations of the love and friendship and even humor and beauty and all that stuff that we should be feeling in our relationship with God.
Yes.
Not that we're feeling it all the time, but, you know, just when you're living your life. And so this pure look at it here on this mountaintop where they're kind of all changing, that is how life is. Mm-hmm. Suddenly something happens that comes to a head and you go, oh my gosh, and your point of view changes. You see clearly. You know?
Yeah. Beautiful. Love it.
Yeah. So it's in that sense, it's all our journey. It's just compressed here.
Yeah. No doubt. You know, I saw myself in a lot of this, even though it was about four women, you know, it's like, I understand that sentiment, you know?
Yeah.
So it was terrific. Yeah.
Yeah.
So thanks for bringing this one.
You're very welcome.
Yes, indeed.
I'm glad you liked it.
I very much did. Yeah. That's cool. All right, so what is next for us? This is something else I haven't seen or read, but this is a movie, Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Oh.
1939. Yeah.
I know, and I'll say this again at the beginning of the next episode, but this is one that took all of us by surprise because of our Oscar-watching project, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we got to this year of the Oscars, 1940 it would have been, since the movie came out in 39. And we put it off to the very end, I think, because I was like, goody, goody, Mr. you know, blah, blah, blah. How boring can it be, school teacher? And we watched it, and we were so utterly surprised at how great this movie was.
That's great.
I instantly switched out one of my other movies I'd picked for it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's just really, it's an unexpected delight. So
oh, good. I'm really looking forward to that. That's great.
Yeah.
So did it win the Oscar, or was it a nominee?
No, it was nominated.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. But anyway, sounds great. I cannot wait to see that movie. Yeah. So that'll be fun. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah. Get that book and read it.
Read that thing. Yeah. It is very much worth it. You bet.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, take care, all.
Yeah.
See you in a couple weeks.
Okay.
Bye.